Good morning and welcome back to Nahyomi. Today we're going to be starting a new sefer. We're going to be starting Megillas Esther. Although Megillas Esther is one of the five Megillos, generally speaking, when we talk about the Megillah, by default, we refer to Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther is near and dear to us, and it perhaps is the most frequented, the most well-known of all the Megillos, for the very simple reason is that we have an obligation to hear it twice a year on the night and the morning of Purim. And is therefore also has an entire Masechta in Gemara in Torah Shabbat called Maseches Megillah. And there is a lot to talk about in the halachic requirements. In fact, the writing of a Megillah has more requirements that are similar to the writing of a Torah than perhaps any of the other Megillahs would have because of the chiyuv of the responsibility to listen to it. Let's take a look at it as an overview. First of all, we know that it is 167 psukim long, divided into 10 10 chapters. If you actually look at the Megillah today, the tradition that we have has 18 paragraph breaks, all of them stumos, which means not full paragraphs, just 8 letter gaps in the middle of a paragraph between 18 separate paragraphs. And generally the Baalei HaMasorah, those who preserve the tradition of the way it is written, have 5 sedarim, 5 main sections of this Megillah, and they all are essentially chapter beginnings, in a certain sense, changes over in the story. The first is Vayhi B'vayei Achashverosh, of course, in the first perek. In the middle of the second perek, Ish Yehudi is the appearance of Mordechai, is the second seder. The third seder is Yeshna Am Echad, that's when Haman now presents his genocidal intent. Then the fourth seder is Kacha Ye'aseh La'ish in perek Vav, when the tide changes against Haman. And finally, Vayayidi Moisah Erev Simcha in perek Ches is the last seder, which is when there's the final turnaround nationally. There's a discussion as to who wrote the Megillah. So the Gemara of Baba Basra and the famous Brisa about authorship in Tanakh tells us in Yud Aleph Amud Beis that this is one of the books, one of the Sfarim, which is attributed to Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly. Anshei Knesset HaGdola were a general group, a council that met and presided at the beginning of the second, the building of the second base of Migdash. Among them were people of the likes of Mordechai, Esther, Zerubbabel, Yeshua, Kohen Gadol, Chagai, Zechariah, Melachi, Ezra, Nehemiah. All these people were part of it. Obviously, it wasn't one generational, it was a number of generations, so it's not clear particularly when in that period it was written. You may say, well, wait a second, if you recall, in the ninth parak of the Megillah, it does say the following: Vayichtov Moshe Mordechai es ha-dvorim ha-ele, vayishlach svarim el kol ha-yudim, asher b'chol medinos ha-melech ha-chashverosh, ha-krovim ha-rochokim. Mordechai wrote this letter, and he sent it out to everybody. So you may say, isn't the Megillah telling us about its authorship inside itself as well? And the answer is not so fast, because that really is truly referring to how the people are supposed to be keeping Purim. L'kayem aleihem yos osim es yom arba'a seyam l'chodesh adar. That's how to keep Purim, but it's not necessarily about the actual authorship of the Megillah. It should be clear that the Megillah was written somewhat later than the time that it is being described, for the reason being is that the Megillah itself seems to describe things to the reader that in a way that the reader is not familiar with. Meaning to say, it describes the way that feasts were conducted. It describes the practices in Persia of that time, almost as if the reader or the writer as well is trying to explain to a generation which is not as clearly aware of it. Yet at the same time, you know, as an example, even Achashverosh. Who Achashverosh? Amolech meyodu v'al kusheva v'esimu me'al medina. Why would we need that if the generation it's being written to was the generation of Mordechai v'Esther right there and then? So it seems that there's we'll call it a retelling, in a way that and we can understand it even beyond. But at the same time, in the 167 psukim, there are 60 plus Persian words itself, indicating there was clearly during the Persian era as well. So this gives the ambiguity, which is exactly what Chazal were saying, that Anshei Knesset HaGdola wrote it, but at the same time there's a little bit of ambiguity as to when precisely during that period of Anshei Knesset HaGdola it was actually fully completed by the last of the Nevi'im. It is worthwhile thinking about the relationship of Megillas Esther to the other books of Nach, because you see there were many other books of Nach written right around this time. So as an example, we do hear reference to it in Sefer Ezra. Sefer Ezra, Perek Dalet, we're going to get there soon in Nahyomi, describes there was and this is in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Vav, Uva Malchus Achashverosh, in the kingdom of when the reign of Achashverosh, b'tchilas malchusoy, kisvu sitna al yoshvei Yehudah Yerushalayim. It was a sitna. It was a letter sent, a preventative letter against the Jews of Jerusalem and Yerushalayim. And if you actually, so to speak, zoom out in Perek Dalet in Ezra, you'll see it's at a critical time in Jewish history. The first wave of resettlement of the land of Israel has occurred. There's been Yehoshua Kohen Gadol, there's been Zerubbabel, yet the inhabitants, the local inhabitants, were not so happy with these Jews returning, and they wrote numerous notes to prevent their resettling and rebuilding in Yerushalayim, and they were listened to. For almost two decades, they weren't able to do anything, in which the period, in the middle of this period, is when Achashverosh rules. And finally, afterwards, we have Artaxerxes, a later king, who allows the rebuilding of Yerushalayim, and that's when Haggai and Zechariah step into the picture in the second tier of the resurgence under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah. So if that's the case, the way it seems to be placed at this point is towards the beginning of the Shivas Tzion movement. It's interesting, though, that Megillas Esther is silent about the other Sforim in Tanakh. Megillas Esther does not relate to what's going on in the land of Israel or other Sforim at that point. So this leads us to the very, very basic and fundamental question as to when did this actually occur. The classic approach is if you look at Sefer Ezra Perek Dalet and you look at the way Chazal interpret this, they say very clearly that we're at the stage where the Beis HaMikdash has not yet been rebuilt. They've not got over that burden, that stumbling block of the neighbors who are not allowing the nation of Israel to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and we're in that in-between time. And Rashi adopts this approach fully in. If you take a look at the Rashi, when it talks about the first Seuda, the first feast, Esther makes a request to the king, and he turns to her and he says, "Maba kashosech al chatzia malchus v'yinos enoch, I'll give you anything until half the kingdom." What's half the kingdom? Rashi explains that Beis HaMikdash at this point in time was on freeze. It was on hold. There was too much political backwards and forwards and storming in the province of Judea. And therefore the king said, "I'm not interested in getting involved. I'll do anything you want, Esther, but I'm not going to reopen that portfolio. I'm not going to touch the Middle East. The Middle East is always the graveyard of any peace process. I'm not touching it." And that's what Achashverosh says. Why? Because Beis HaMikdash is not built yet. However, from the academic approach, if you do a quick look at the annals and the archives of history, there's a lot of attempts to try to identify who Achashverosh actually was. The classical approach in academic research is that he was a man by the name of Xerxes, right? And this is the Xerxes is, in fact, the way it is pronounced is Kshayarsha, which is in Greek, Xerxes. Xerxes the first was one of the fourth of the Achaemenid Empire. So he followed his father, was Darius the Great. He was the follower of Darius the Great. And in fact, he was the grandson of Cyrus the Great, the first of the kings of this particular dynasty. Now, what's important about this is not only did he had a failed invasion of Greece, but he was actually able to quell the Egyptians. And we have a lot of the writings about Xerxes from Herodotus and a number of Greek historians later on. What is interesting about it is they have very little to say about his domestic policies and what goes on politically in his own kingdom, which gives the space to say that potentially for numerous reasons it could be Xerxes. For instance, he's described as being a person who was very lustful after women. He had a man of many parties, who was very politically active, was seen as a very strong leader, and leads many people to suggest that, in fact, Xerxes was Achashverosh. There are many questions to ask. For instance, Xerxes had a wife, and her name was not Esther or Vashti. So there are answers that he could have had many wives, as many of those kings did. It is also, and perhaps more for us, more important for us, is that he lives later on. He lives in the years 518 to 465 before Common Era, which is actually a little bit later than we'll call it the immediate following of the Babylonian exile. And that being the case, it's hard to understand Pesukim like Mordechai was the one who was exiled in the goddess Yechonia, which was really quite far back, if it were to be Xerxes. So those who adopt this approach, there are many from people adopt this approach. As an example, Rav Moshe Chacham in Da'at Mikra, looking at the annals and doing and working out the years. It says, well, it could be that Mordechai, when it describes that Mordechai was going into exile, wasn't Mordechai per se. It was perhaps the generations before him that went into exile. That being the case, there's a lot of complexity as to the Persian annals and how Chazal, in fact, map out, based on the Seder Olam, those years. The Chazal take it very minimalistically, but it's very clear, even Rashi admits, that there were extra kings in the Persian annals, which Chazal were not relating to. As Rashi talks about Cambyses, who was not part of the list of the four kings of Koresh, Daryavesh, and Artaxasta, and Archashverosh. So there were clearly more kings in the Persian dynasty. Why Chazal were minimized it is a fascinating topic, the topic of many, many, many fascinating essays on the topic. But be as it may, if this is in fact the truth, that Xerxes was Achashverosh, that would mean to say that this would actually not occur before the Beis HaMikdash is built, but actually after the Beis HaMikdash is built. So you may say, well, that changes the whole game then. The answer is no, it actually makes the whole game much more powerful and poignant. Rachaim Angel has a beautiful essay on this topic. And he says, now reread the Megillah. Reread Megillah's Esther, understanding that there could at this point in time being a Beis HaMikdash standing in the land of Israel. And understand the pain that Mikdash and that settlement in the land of Israel is absolutely absent from the Megillah. How painful is that? How clear is it where the political hub and center of power is in the world at this point in time? And it's not Israel. It's not Judea. It's Shushan. That shows you how deficient, how lacking. And that's what when it says that Haggai described the building of the Beis HaMikdash, how those who saw the first Beis HaMikdash wept. It was so small. It was so minute and humble compared to the first Beis HaMikdash. In fact, if you read the Mishnayos, there was a wall in the second Beis HaMikdash called the Shushan Wall. It had a mural of Shushan because that's where his benefactors sent the money from. Understand how terrifying this idea is that in fact, the Megillah is in a certain sense, in absence, it's not even Mesiaches, it doesn't even relate to the major Jewish community, which is a community in the land of Israel. Would this relate to this, or actually in fact, brings us back to a very important question. That question is what is the point of Megillah? Why is Megillah written? One clue which is interesting is that the name of Hashem is not present in the Megillah whatsoever. And this relates to actually the name of Esther herself. The Gemara asks, Esther min HaTorah minayin, how do we know Esther was in fact from the Torah? Obviously she appears in Nach. But where do we see the Shoresh Nishmasa, the idea of who she is in the Torah? So the Gemara quotes the Pasuk, Astir Ponah B'Yomahu, I'm going to hide my face, doubly hide my face on that day. Hashem's not present, but he's absolutely present. In fact, there's a minag today, you'll take a look at certain Megillahs, where it's called Megillas HaMelech, where every column begins with the word HaMelech, except for the first column and really the last two columns, which means it's HaMelech, 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 HaMelech. The Gemara tells us that every Melech in the Megillah, except for one or two, are in fact relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is steering history through the Megillah. So on the one hand, Hashem's name is absent. On the other hand, Hashem is very much transcendent. And this goes back to, we'll close with this, what a very, very famous Gemara in Shabbos says, which is a tremendously profound point. The Gemara is going back to Matan Torah, and it says, "Vayisatzu besachtis ahor on Shabbos peiches amud aleph." And the Gemara says, quoting Rav Adimi Bar Chava Bar Chasa, who says that in fact, HaKadosh Baruch Hu held the mountain above their heads and says, "If you accept the Torah, good mutav im lav shom tiyek kvor aschem, then you will be buried over there." So the Gemara says, asks a very basic question. If you put a gun to somebody's head and you say, you know, please sign away your assets, of course that's not valid because the person did that because they didn't want to get shot, not because they wanted to hand over the assets. That's under coercion. So therefore, any time in Jewish history that the nation of Israel would sin and get punished, they could say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you put a gun to our heads, you held the mountain over our heads, so why should we be liable? So the Gemara says, no, don't worry. Hadar kiblu abimei Achashverosh, the Gemara says. They accepted the Torah again in the times of Achashverosh. Tiasiv kimu v'kiblu ayudim kimu ma'ashe kiblu kvar. They accepted, based on the Pasuk, in the end of the Megillah, that they accepted what was accepted at Sinai already. So one second. So let me get this right. So that means to say that it was true that they had a gun to their heads. But then if the real acceptance only came to the time of Purim, then what about all the years before, the 1,000 years almost, in between Matan Torah and Purim? So how does that work? So what comes out here is a very powerful truth. And that is that to the degree that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is imminent in our lives, to the degree there's prophecy, clear prophecy, incandescent connection between the divine and the human being, it's very hard to make the wrong decision. Unless there's going to be another forces of Avodah Zarah in the world. But really, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells you what to do, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals himself in the most incandescent way at Har Sinai, there is no choice left. What it means to say that Hashem held the mountain over their heads wasn't that he threatened them by throwing rocks at them. What it means to say is he revealed the real transcendent reality of himself. And there was no alternative that we had to make any other decisions because it was so clear what was right. Yes, could we jump off the building? Yes, but it was like jumping into a fire. Could we do that? No. Could we do that? Yes. So therefore, in a certain sense, there was a sublimation of free will. That's what the Gemara is saying. The Gemara says, but wait a second. If there was a sublimation of free will during the period of prophecy, then how could they ever be held accountable for disobedience? The Gemara says, no. There was going to come a time when prophecy was ebbing away. And when did that time happen? When was the end of the Nevi'im? When was the time when the last of the prophets lived? It was at the times of Purim. It was the times of Purim where there's no explicit prophecy. Esther doesn't get told, this is what you should do. Mordechai doesn't get a dream at night saying, you know, this is what you should do. That'll work it out. Maybe we should fast, we should pray, we should plead, we should... Mordechai and Esther are pleading with one another. You should go, you shouldn't go in Perek Dalet. What's going on over here? So what's interesting about this is that ultimately... it's the human being having to grope through the darkness to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Gemara's painting to us is two extremes. Matan Torah, where it's so clear HaKadosh Baruch Hu is talking to us. And then a period later on history, which is going to now be the metaphor, it's going to be the model for all of our existence there afterwards, which is the Esther and Mordechai model, which is having to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu through using our culture, through our Torah, through our minds, to be able to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu and apply that in that particular situation. Much more complex reality, and that's what's called Model B, which is Megillas Esther, which is why it is so significant. What's the point of Megillas Esther? Is to be able to read a book in Tanakh without HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name and understand that he is ever present in that moment, because this is the end of prophecy. We now get the chance to start Perek by Perek. Have a wonderful and meaningful day.